time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Laura, the SEC at long last released the final version of the ETF rule this past Thursday. This thing is 259 pages long. Now, I know you had a busy weekend with a March for the Fallen, which I do want to ask you about. But be honest here. Did you actually read this entire document?
I got most of it done. I still have a few chapters left to go, so don't spoil how it ends. But it ended up being my light plane reading to and from the march. Actually, funny enough, I ended up explaining and discussing the ETF rule with a bunch of people I met over the course of the hike. So definitely top of people's minds, even if you're not obsessively watching the ETF market like I am.
Well, okay, so for people who maybe aren't as close to the ETF industry or for investors who simply want to better understand the impact of the ETF rule, I guess a good starting point is to explain how ETFs have been operating, right? Because that'll then allow us to highlight why this rule is important. So let's start there. Do you want to explain the basics of how ETFs have been operating since 1993 from a regulatory perspective, and then we can get into all the details of this rule?
Sure. So like you said earlier, ETFs have existed up to this point in time as an exception to the rules. For the past 25, 26 years, if an issuer wanted to get into the business of launching ETFs, they first had to obtain what it's known as, quote, exemptive relief. And that's an order from the SEC essentially saying, it's okay that you're going to bend these rules, and here are the specific ways in which you can bend them, right? But getting this relief order has been kind of a time-consuming process. It's been expensive for issuers. It adds months onto the process of launching an ETF, and it costs, in the early days, it cost upwards of $1 million. Now it's closer to, a couple 10,000, but that's still a lot of money, right? And it clogs up the SEC's pipeline, and, they'd rather spend their time debating the merits of Bitcoin ETFs, I am sure. More importantly, though, these orders have been written and granted on an individualized basis. I believe Todd said something to that effect earlier. That means that they've evolved over time. So a good example is with leveraged and inverse products, right? So until 2009, the SEC was granting relief for anybody who wanted to launch leveraged and inverse products. Nobody has gotten exemptive relief since 2009. They decided to stop. Nobody's gotten it. So that means anybody who had the relief order already can still launch new funds, but now nobody else can, right? So nobody who's come to the market in the past 10 years can launch these funds. So as you can see, this kind of creates an unlevel playing field within the industry. Generally speaking, the older orders tended to be more flexible. So you see the legacy players like State Street and BlackRock and Vanguard, they have more capability than the newer folks coming to market. And that wasn't necessarily anything like nefarious from the SEC or anything. It was just an unintended consequence of the fact that their orders have evolved over time. So the ETF rule fixes most of that by saying, yes, okay, we're going to allow ETFs to exist, not as an exemption to the rules, but as an application of this new rule. So now there's this standardized definition of what an ETF is, what it does, and everybody can follow it. There's no more need to apply for exemptive relief when you're launching a fund. And in fact, the SEC is actually rescinding most of the exemptive relief orders that they've already issued.
So I think one of the obvious takeaways here is that for ETF issuers, it'll be easier to bring new products to market, right? Lower costs. There's not going to have to jump through as many regulatory hoops. So theoretically, I think that could lead to more ETF innovation, which we can talk about. But I guess beyond that, from the perspective of investors, what do you think are some of the most important benefits of this rule?
Right. So one of the things that really jumped out at me, and I think is probably the most positive benefit of this rule for investors, is that it requires more enhanced reporting on certain trading aspects of ETFs. So now issuers, they have to publish on a daily basis their portfolio holdings. They have to publish historical trading premiums and discounts. They have to publish median bid-ask spreads over the course of the past month and so on. So like all of this has to be readily accessible and published on the fund's website, all in one place, no hiding that. And I think maybe, you know, you've heard some issuer angst over the logistical burden of providing this information. But to me, it's like 100% an unqualified good thing that investors are going to have more transparency into these metrics. You know, more transparency, more data. To me, that's better. You just have to, at this point, make sure that everybody knows what those metrics mean. But it's a good thing that they're there. I do want to point out one little exception to that, and that's that the ETF rule kind of does away with the concept of INAV, indicative net asset value. And this was a metric that was published every so often during the trading day, every 15 seconds, I believe. And it was supposed to provide people a way to see what the net asset value of the fund was during the trading day. And it did its job. It was good to have it, but I don't think it was really that well understood by investors. And sometimes it could get a little misleading when you had price dislocations in the market. Like, for example, when the trading hours of the underlying securities were different than those of, the ETF, like if you had an overseas fund or something. So it could get a little misleading in that regard. Also, a lot of liquidity providers, they just kind of calculated their own version of the INAV. So, I don't think we're really losing too much by getting rid of this concept. But I should point out, that it's not there anymore.
And Laura, with the additional transparency and disclosure, so you mentioned things like bid-ask spreads, premium and discounts. Just to be clear, some ETF providers had been providing this information already on their websites. It's just that now that's a requirement.
Oh, of course. Yes. I'd say the vast majority of people in the ETF industry were already providing a lot of this information on their websites. There are a few notable exceptions, though.
Yeah. And one of the things I think is important here, too, is, a lot of people focus on the expense ratio for ETFs, but you do have to look at the total cost of ETF ownership, which does include things like bid-ask spreads and premiums and discounts. So I think clearly important for investors. What about this ability to use custom baskets
as part of the ETF rule? Really good point.
Do you want to explain what that means and perhaps what some of the benefits are?
Right. Okay. So a little bit of ETF 101 here. Whenever new shares of an ETF are going to be either made or taken off the market, issuers rely on what are known as authorized participants. These are special investors who have the ability to make and destroy new shares of an ETF. And to do this, they give to the issuer a proportional basket of underlying securities in the ETF in exchange for a fixed number of shares of the ETF called a creation unit. That's if they're going to make shares. And if they're destroying shares, it works in reverse. They deliver, creation units worth of ETF shares, and they get the underlying securities instead. So generally speaking, the securities that APs have to give and get, they have to be some sort of proportional slice of the total ETF portfolio. But some exemptive relief orders, mostly older ones from before 2005, they allowed issuers to use what's known as, quote, custom baskets. And these are baskets that differ from that pro rata slice. And there are lots of reasons why you might want to use a custom basket. Maybe you have an enormous portfolio, like you're dealing with thousands and thousands of individual bonds. And instead of, grabbing a slice of each one of those bonds, you want to use a representative sample instead. Or maybe you're in the middle of a rebalance, right? And you want to replace a security from your portfolio with a new one that you like. So you can put the one that you want to get rid of in the redemption basket, and you can put the new one in your creation basket. So using a custom basket tends to minimize issuers' trading costs. It makes your AP's life easier, and it conceivably leads to lower trading spreads. Now, the ETF rule now allows everybody to have custom baskets, so long as they publish in writing how this benefits investors and they do, you know, the disclosures that we just talked about. And so that kind of erases the, you know, again, the unlevel playing field. It levels it. Now the newer folks can do the same thing that the older folks were doing. And conceivably, that could, you know, help increase tax efficiency for ETFs kind of across the industry.
Laura, going back to a comment I made earlier that it will be easier for ETF issuers to bring new products to market, what do you think this means for ETF launches moving forward? Like, do you think we'll see an uptick in new launches? And then as I think about potential benefits to end investors, you know, typically more competition tends to have the effect of lowering costs as well, right? So I guess two questions here. I mean, one, do you think we'll see an uptick in ETF launches because they're easier to bring to market? And then if so, do you think that sort of puts further downward pressure on costs?
I think to your first point, yes, I do think we're going to see, I don't know if the floodgates are opening, right? But we will see it be easier for new products to come to market, but specifically new products from new issuers, right? Who may have been kind of gatekept by the time outlay and the cost outlay of coming to market in the ETF industry. So we might see some new names come into the industry over the next, you know, year or so. As far as bringing down costs, this is just going to intensify the fee wars, right? I can't see that it wouldn't. Once you get more people flooding into a market, it's all just, you know, that's... I think that's going to be one way that people can distinguish between a whole bunch of new funds, right, is their cost. So for sure, yeah.
Are there any particular areas where you think new launches are more likely? So you know, I think about maybe fixed income ETFs or active ETFs, given that custom baskets can now be used. Do you think that might be the case?
I think yes. You know, active certainly will be something that benefits the active ETF space and fixed income ETF space. I actually think we might see more thematic ETFs come to market. You know, maybe more ESG funds or more, you know, narrow slice tech funds or something like that. I think anybody who's got a good idea now, who might have been scared away by this barrier to entry, they can come to market now so long as they play by the rules.
Okay, so you know that I always like to play devil's advocate anytime we talk about pretty much anything. And look, overall, I don't think there's any question the ETF rule is being viewed as a huge positive, right? And actually, your colleague, Dave Nottig, he told Barron's last week that this is arguably the most important piece of regulatory action to hit the ETF industry since 1993. And he said, quote, it's a rare win for both investors and the industry. But I do want to flip this around a little bit. Do you think there are any negatives to this rule, or maybe things that didn't make it into the final rule that you think should have been included?
So rather than, I think the biggest negative, and it's not even necessarily a negative per se, but it's just something that people need to kind of keep in mind when we're talking about the ETF rule, is that yes, the rule standardizes the process of launching an ETF, but it doesn't standardize it for everybody, right? So there are actually several categories of ETFs for which this new rule doesn't apply. One of them is unit investment trusts. That's an older form of ETF. Most ETFs now are open-ended funds. But when they were first coming to market, the unit investment trust structure was a little bit more popular. Now there's only, I think, like 11 ETFs now that are still unit investment trusts, but they're big. They're huge, right? So SPY is a unit investment trust. The Qs, a unit investment trust. So they don't have to follow the same rules as the ETF rule. They just follow the exemptive relief order that they have already been granted. That's one of the ones that hadn't been rescinded. The ETF rule doesn't apply to leveraged and inverse products. They still have to apply for exemptive relief on an individualized basis if you want to launch these products. Same thing with those new non-transparent active ETF structures that we're seeing, like the ones from Precidian and Active Shares and so on. They're starting to become a bigger deal, I guess, you know, kind of the forefront of the market, coming to market, I should say. Those folks have to apply for exemptive relief like everybody else. Now, there's one big category of people that, you know, that don't apply, or that that the ETF rule doesn't apply to, and that's ETFs which exist as a share class of another fund, meaning literally all of the Vanguard brand ETFs are exempt from the ETF rule. So I did the math when I was covering the rule when it first launched, and while only about 120 ETFs are exempted, those ETFs represent over $1 trillion in assets invested in this industry. That's 37% of the total assets. So there's a fair bit of money that is not going to be dictated by the ETF rule.
Yeah, I saw that stat that you put out last week, and I think I made the comment, you know, this is still not entirely a level playing field, right? When you have somebody like Vanguard with over $1 trillion in assets that doesn't have to abide by all of the same rules here. So I agree with that. Something else I tweeted out last week that I'd be curious to get your thoughts. The SEC decided to hold off on implementing an ETF naming system. So BlackRock had put forth this initiative to label products in a way that investors could better understand them. So, you know, for example, leverage and inverse products or exchange traded notes, they would be labeled in a different way. They couldn't be called ETFs. And I know that can get pretty hairy trying to determine what goes into to, you know, which classification. But I do think it would help investors, if nothing else, just as a very initial check when you're looking at a product to see that it's called something else, that, hey, maybe this doesn't behave the same as a plain vanilla ETF. Any thoughts on that? Were you surprised that that wasn't in the final rule?
I mean, my initial thoughts on it is it felt to me like, and reading through the document, you see it kind of specific to leveraged and inverse products, right? There was this attempt by commenters to sort of wall off leveraged and inverse products from being called ETFs. And I mean, they are ETFs. Like they functionally, mechanically are the same as, you know, any, they function the same as any other ETFs. So it felt a little, not arbitrary, but I just couldn't see the reasoning there. And already there are so many different acronyms and different names being bandied about. It just didn't seem like something that I think the SEC made the right call on that, holding off on relabeling different segments of the market.
No, that's fair. I guess, you know, I just think back to like the XIV blow up last year. And just because that may have been called something different, that's not going to, that wouldn't have prevented some investors from getting bludgeoned there. I just think anything that can better help people understand, you know, what they're investing in could be a benefit. But I read through that commentary in the SEC document as well. And again, they made the point that, you know, it's really, they receive comments. It's really difficult. How do you classify what goes where? It's not as easy as it may look on the surface. Okay. So, Laura,
and I don't think it would, I'm sorry, just one last point. I don't think it would actually add any more clarity to the market. I think it would just introduce more confusion because now you've got to know what all of these different acronyms mean, right? So I don't know.
Okay. So when will this rule officially go into effect? What's the process here from now?
Right. So it goes into effect 60 days from when the rule has been published in the Federal Register. And I checked yesterday and I didn't see it there, but it's, you know, very possible I might have missed it or it came in afterwards. Anyway, 60 days after that, the ETF rule officially goes live and we are living in the ETF rule world.
Okay. So do we think before the end of the year then?
You're asking me to do basic arithmetic on air. And of course I can't do that. If not the end of the year, then certainly, you know, in the opening weeks of 2020.
Okay. So before I let you go, I do want to come back around and ask you about the March for the Fallen event that you participated in this past week. And so the team over at Alpha Architect, they do an amazing job garnering support for this event. Of course, Wes Gray served as a captain in the Marines. But as I understand it, this march honors military servicemen and women who have given the ultimate sacrifice for our country. I'm just curious, what was the event like? It's an event I certainly want to attend at some point. I haven't been able to do it the past couple of years, but what was the event like and how did the march itself go for you?
Right. So it was, it's actually a march held by the broader community, a Pennsylvania National Guard general is the one who actually organized the event, founded the event. He doesn't organize it now, but the National Guard has taken it over. So there were about 700 people at this march, and roughly 120 of them were people that Wes Gray had somehow convinced from the financial industry to come do it. And he's just a force of nature. If you've ever met him, he's an incredibly charismatic person, and a genuinely good person too. So I'm not surprised that he was able to convince so many people to come. Now, the march itself is 28 miles in the Pennsylvania woods. It's held on a National Guard training facility, an actual base. So you're marching along, you know, military equipment and training facilities and so on. But most of it takes place in the woods. And there is, I said it was 28 miles. The full version is 28 miles while carrying a 35-pound rucksack. Now, you don't have to do it that way. Like, there are plenty of people who do the 28 miles without the rucksack. And there's also a much shorter version. There's a 14-mile version, which I did that version. And it still was hell on my feet. So it was a fun experience. You know, it was a very profound experience too. Like you said, this is a march to honor fallen service members who didn't come back from their deployment. Very much a living memorial, quote, living memorial. This is how the general described it to me. So by putting yourself out there, by putting yourself in the shoes of the people who, you know, getting kind of a taste of what it's like to exert yourself in this fashion, you know, you're keeping people's memory alive. And, you know, at every mile marker, for example, they had a photo and a name of somebody who didn't make it. There was a memorial wall at the finish line of names and faces of service members who were killed in action. And a lot of the volunteers and participants were Gold Star family members. Before the event, there was actually a woman who spoke, who was a Gold Star member, Gold Star family member whose brother had died by suicide while deployed. And she just told us how much it meant to her that that so many people had come out and that so many people were dedicated to keeping the memory alive. And just, it was an incredibly profound experience. So I'll be
such an amazing
writing
event
up my thoughts later.
Now I need to make it out to that one of these years. Laura, we'll have to leave it there. Excellent stuff as always this week. I know you've been all over this ETF story or this ETF rule story from the very beginning. Regulatory matters, of course, aren't the easiest thing in the world to make digestible, right? But I think you've done a great job with it. So thank you. Certainly appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger.